Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
I'm Chris Renor.
And I'm Tosin Unafawakin.
This week we keep it short and sweet. The first businesses start to ban Google Glass, even before it's out. The U.S. reinforces our right to videotape the police. SimCity players speak out against draconian DRM and dead servers. And the world's coolest gamer dad hacks Donkey Kong so the girl rescues Mario. But first, occasionally we like to do a segment we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the tech that has obsessed us through the week. And last week, I mentioned that I had just gotten my Pebble, which is the Kickstarter watch that integrates with your iPhone. And I'm sorry to say, but I got a lemon, because within like the first 3 days of getting the watch and charging it up, the display faded so that it's completely unreadable at this point. And actually, you know, it's interesting that it's interesting that this happened, because it gave me an interesting sort of realization that I was not aware of before, or maybe it was a misconception that I had, that the Pebble doesn't actually use e-paper as its display technology. It's actually a low energy LCD display.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
There's no e-ink at all?
No. I mean, they call it they call it e-ink, but it's not really, it's not technically e-paper. Let me see if I can.
So what's the distinction between e-ink and e-paper? I imagine e-paper is the medium on which you can put e-ink, but is it possible that the LCD is also making use of e-paper?
That would make sense, Dwayne. This is marketing speak we're talking about here.
Yeah, it is marketing speak. E-paper or e-paper is what is that sort of like fluid medium that has a dark and a light side, and it's electrically charged to either display the dark or the light side of the fluid, and it only changes its display when something changes, and then otherwise it's in a passive state. That's e-paper. E-ink is a marketing term that can sort of be an umbrella term for e-paper as well as other technologies. And let me see if I can read from the website, because there was a thread that came up while I was looking at why my display failed. Okay, here we go. Pebble uses a low-power, sharp, monochrome LCD display and not an e-ink display. Oh, that's it. So it is e-paper, which is an umbrella term, but it's not e-ink.
Yeah, e-ink seems to be a name for a particular type of e-paper technology.
Right. So e-paper, I think e-paper is defined by sort of its flexibility, its thinness and flexibility, but that doesn't mean it's e-paper. So it's essentially a low-power LCD that is the display technology and the Pebble. And, you know, I kind of realized this when I was looking at the display, because not only did it sort of fade and completely disappear, but also when it was active, I noticed that I would get some, when I had a particular display on for a long time and I changed to another display, I would see ghosting in the background, like an after image of the previous display. The kind of thing that we used to see with plasma displays when plasma displays first came out.
So it's not just a straight up like LCD display either. Because I'd be really surprised if you got like a lemon on that. I mean, that's, you know, old established technology, if there is any.
Yeah.
So it's something sort of between the two?
It's something sort of between the two. It's a they call it memory LCD. Sharp does. And it's a it's low power consumption, and I'm not sure what other sort of things distinguish it from a regular LCD, but they're using Sharp technology on that display. It's LCD, not e-ink, and that is, I think, one of the primary reasons why this why it's prone to sort of malfunctioning more than e-paper, because e-paper is fairly passive.
Yeah. Have you gotten sort of any sense of how common these are? I haven't heard yet of any sort of.
You know, I'm active on the forum now at Pebble since having this situation occur, and it's the first incident like this that I've seen on the entire forum. I sent a trouble ticket into the Pebble guys, and I'm told that it takes them about a week and a half to respond because either they're short-staffed or they're running into a lot of other. If you go through the forums, you'll see that there's a lot of other technical issues that people are having with the device as well.
Yeah. You know, that's just one of the. I mean, I guess we're going to see this more with. As Kickstarter sort of takes off and there are more sort of startups that are able to hit, you know, critical mass fairly quickly with products. But, like, there's an awful lot of scaling that happens when you're building up a product. I mean, you know, we've been discovering that and we don't even have a huge amount of scale yet. But, you know, supporting people takes a lot of manpower and there's just no way around it. And it's if you're an early adopter, like I guess early adopter with hardware is no different from early adopter with software. I think we're sort of acculturated to sort of expect beta software to be a little bit buggy, but we're not as sort of open to beta hardware being buggy.
Right, because we assume
that's essentially what this is.
Yeah, yeah. Like we assume that when we get a when we go to a department store and buy a piece of hardware or electronics. That it's been thoroughly tested. It's had, you know, months of lab testing, and they've worked out all the kinks. With this particular product, with the Pebble and other products on Kickstarter, a lot of times you'll see the developers openly working through the kinks online. You know, they'll be posting about it in the forums, and you see there are sort of like trials and tribulations of getting like Chinese fabricators to make their unique devices, and I know that they're not going through anywhere near the sort of thorough road testing that Apple and Samsung and other manufacturers go through when they make their electronic products. So yeah, we're all kind of guinea pigs.
Yeah, this is why, like, I don't know, I've sort of, maybe this will change if at some point my ship comes in or something, but, like, when it comes to software, I will just sign up for anything and play around with anything and use anything, but when it comes to hardware, I'm extremely conservative just because, like, unless it's sort of like a throwaway type thing, like, I kind of expect the first versions are going to be kind of janky.
Well, so long as they're honorable about, you know, returns and exchanges, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanna see what, you know, the time it takes between responses and just that process for you. That's where I'm curious in terms of, you know, how they deal with it. Are they going to try and be, you know, like Zappos in terms of customer support and success?
Wow.
Or, you know,
that would be nice. Zappos is one of a kind.
Yeah.
Customer service.
You know, I wonder if we're going to see a little bit of a change coming forward. I mean, like hardware companies in general have not historically been that great with support. I mean, Apple's a bit of an outlier, but I mean, I had an Asus computer from a few years ago that I, you know, called up with a support ticket on, and I swear it was like being in a Kafka novel, like just exploring this, you know, Byzantine labyrinth of like not really labyrinth. Like it wasn't there wasn't a support structure. I mean, I managed to do okay because I worked in IT and have a pretty good sense of how to press the right buttons to get through. But and Ace is a huge manufacturer. Like there's an awful lot of companies out there aside from the ones that sort of really have big name presences that basically have no support structure at all. I don't know. I wonder if that's going to change.
Like Google?
Google has no support structure at all. I will tell you that.
Well, I mean, when they open a store, it'll be a different story, right? Like, part of it is when you work with a company like Asus or you know, the old Gateway or whatever, and they don't really have a strong retail presence. You're buying it from a retailer, like you're going to a Walmart or a Best Buy or whatever. They simply don't have the personnel in place to really service your devices. That's what made Dell so amazing. You could put your, you know, a Dell person could show up at your door depending on how much you paid initially, or you could send it back to them and they'd send you other, they'd send you pieces. They'd send you either send you pieces or they'd send you the whole computer back or they'd replace it. And that really turned them on. Gateway, they didn't have that reputation. They tried to open up some stores. It didn't really work out. Where's Gateway today, you know? With Asus, they're kind of suffering from the same thing. They want to be mass market, but in the end, they're like, I'm a good provider. Sometimes my goods fail. That's why I give them 30 days of whatever. After that, it's kind of up to you. And that's one of those things. When you have that retail presence, like what Microsoft is trying to do with its Windows stores, what Google is trying to do with its Google stores, and what Apple has done with its Apple stores, you begin to see that the customer loyalty is much higher because if you do have those hardware issues, someone's there. You know, they're accountable. Someone can walk into the store. Someone can make a scene. And I think that's one of the incentives that keeps those companies straightforward and honest. And that's probably why Apple has such a good Apple Care, because they realize how much cheaper it is to kind of set up an insurance program where, you know, several people pay $100 or $200 if it's a Mac or whatever. And that's much cheaper than having someone bring their machine into the store.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of those cost benefit things. Like, if you have the infrastructure set up for it, then it certainly works. If you don't, then if you're working on much lower margins, like most of the other ORMs are, or OEMs are, you know, it's much harder for them to have enough sort of overhead to support. Honestly, this is, I don't know, this goes back to, you know, so when I was in college and high school, I made a couple extra bucks every so often by basically providing support to, you know, my local neighborhood, just general tech support and whatever. You know, in most other large expense situations, like cars and homes and everything, like, there is somebody who specializes in providing, you know, direct-to-consumer support. Like, you don't just take apart your sink, you call a plumber. Like, you don't just, you know, take apart your car, you call an auto mechanic. And there just isn't really a vibrant and good market for computing and technology in that same way. I mean, it's a different market because it changes so fast.
There's been attempts at it, but I think the idea is to move in that direction. That's why, like, your Geek Squad is around. You know, there used to be independent computer shops that would fix things, but I think the issue is for the most part, throughout the 90s and the early 2000s, you know, computers were things that you could, they were off-the-shelf pieces, you could take things apart, you could like tinker with it. This is how it was with cars back before Model T was a really big thing. But as we're getting to this place with Ultrabooks and, you know, the other devices like the MacBook Retina is where you've got the battery taped and glued inside against the glass and all that.
Yeah, I know.
You're getting to a point where you are going to need a professional to take it apart and, you know, completely service it. That's what happens with the iPhones. You know, you can't exactly – you used to be able to do stuff like replace your own glass or your own ball on the BlackBerry or whatever. And now you just kind of have to take it in and they have to refurbish it, and that's kind of how it is. So I feel like as these devices become more specialized and become more expensive, that's a big part of it. A car is like a quarter of someone's salary, even more than that, really. So you look at that and you look at like sort of what it takes to like maintain that and use it safely. That's a big part of it. And also your house, there's a big safety issue there too. Structural engineering is involved. Electrical is involved. You know, you could really do some serious damage. The problem with a computer is that if something really goes wrong, with the exception of the software or files that you have on it, there's no life or death situation that really shows up, you know?
Yeah, I understand sort of. I just wonder if there's going to be some sort of tipping point where, I mean, granted, it's always going to be a different model. I don't think the model that works for, you know, cars is going to be the same as the model that works for computing. I mean, maybe some of it will come from the change to the cloud. Like, people will basically pay a premium for particularly friendly cloud services, like maybe Dropbox or whatnot, that actually provide good levels of support in exchange for basically not have to worrying about the hardware, so that the hardware becomes decoupled from the actual data that makes it valuable. Because, I mean, although the actual machine is not valuable that much, I mean, super high-end computer, I mean, even a MacBook Pro is, you know, maybe like a month or two, you know, to save up for. It's not like a car where, you know, it could be easily your quarter of your year salary. But like, you're still going to need to, like, the data, and that is, you know, irreplaceable. And that's why people want, you know, a need, I think, that sort of support. It's just, we have to figure out, you know, what sort of economic system is going to actually be able to provide that in a sustainable way.
I think there's a lot of kinks to be worked out in the whole the whole support chain, particularly for little startups, little Kickstarter startups like that. Yeah. So we'll see how that irons itself out in the years to come as the test cases like me, they learn from the experience of disgruntled customers. All right, let's talk about some headlines here. We talked about Google. We've been talking about Google's Project Glass for a while now, because basically
a straight month of episodes.
It seems like it, doesn't
it? No, it's true. I'm using the data. It's a straight month of episodes now.
Well, I mean, remember when the Segway came out and people were talking about that every week?
I have no recollection of when the Segway came out. I couldn't
really. I remember that.
This is kind of the same thing. So Google's Project Glass spectacles are still in development, not yet available for purchase, but Seattle's Five Point Cafe is getting ahead of the game. They posted a message on Facebook last week that said, "For the record, the Five Point is the first Seattle business to ban in advance Google Glasses, and ass kickings will be encouraged for violators."
Is it just me, or does that sound like hipsters? That sounds like a big publicity.
I'm fairly sure it's a big publicity.
It is.
Yeah.
They also mentioned that in the article, that part of it was truthful, but also part of it was a publicity stunt.
Yeah.
But I mean, and
when
even
you
the article,
asking, it has to be a stunt.
Yeah. Even the article also mentioned that the business owner also has video cameras in there too. So it's that same sort of concept of who's watching who, and when does that become acceptable?
Well, you know, I think there's a big difference between a business owner watching and taking care of his business by having cameras in there, and a consumer coming in and possibly, you know, doing something that the business owner can't control within their business. If you've got your Google Glass on and you sneak into the ladies' room or some shit like that, that brings liability to the business in ways that, you know, they can't even contemplate.
But you could do the same thing with your cell phone, right?
You could, but the thing is, like you said before, not everyone knows what it is. A lot of people don't. So they can be like, oh, I don't know what's going on. Whatever. The fact is, if you want to control the image of your space, then you have to, on some level, have some control of the images taken in your space. You know how cameras work. You know how this other stuff works. Business is typically conservative when it comes to its portrayal and its bread and butter. If they're at all worried or getting the vibe that people aren't going to come in because they feel whatever, then, you know, I mean, I'm taking this to the next level, and degree, but then as a business, I'm not going to mess with that. You know, I'm going to do what I can to maintain a status quo that will make me have the most customers and make the most money. That's just what businesses do. So, and to be honest, the idea that that there's footage being taken or whatever when people aren't aware, or people aren't completely aware, or the entire population's unaware, that's something that a lot of places would have an issue with. you know, that's just the nature of the beast.
We saw the same thing when you first started to see lots of camera phones, where right. there was a lot of concern right. about, you know, camera phones in, you know, locker rooms and camera phones in
and they had to deal with that stuff. Japan had when the iPhone 3G came out in 2008, the Japanese version of the device, you couldn't mute the camera. The camera always made noise because people were using locker rooms, people were using to take upskirt photos, all sorts of stuff. So, I mean, like, I think on some level, until it's like, people will abuse the technology. There's no doubt about it. It's what always happens. So on some level, you know, I think this is a stunt. It's an unnecessary announcement. It's, you know, whatever. Right. But on some level, you know, there is the fact that, you know, you're going to control. If you're a business owner and you're of a coffee shop, your margins are probably, in Seattle, your margins are probably getting you where you need to get anyway. They're probably just barely there. Any kind of disruption on that is going to, you know, just screw up your livelihood as well as the livelihood of the people you employ. So, you know, that's where that conservative approach comes from, I imagine.
Yeah, he says that his quote about it is, first you have to understand the culture of the 5-point, which is sometimes seedy, maybe notorious place. People want to go there and be not known and definitely don't want to be secretly filmed or videotaped, hence the hypocrisy about him actually having a video.
But it's not hypocrisy for him to protect himself on both fronts. Just because someone has a camera in their space watching the space and someone else, and they're saying, hey, look, I don't want people coming in, whatever. It's because you as a space owner, it's like data, right? Like data on a website. The privacy policy says we can collect everything, but it also says you can't hack into my shit and take other people's stuff. So it's the same relative idea, you know. So I want to throw out the idea that there's any kind of hypocrisy here.
In addition to that, he also says that he's saving people from looking like a complete idiot in public. You'll be thankful in a few years when your kids grow up and don't have to see photos of you wearing those ridiculous things. But then if you wear these things, your chance of having children will go way down. So maybe they'll be good for population control.
Wow. It's kind of hilarious. But yeah, it's one of those things. On some level, I mean, you've all seen the Michael Jackson interview from like 2007 or something, 2006. Have you seen that?
No, I don't know what you're. I don't know what you're.
So this British, I think it was Sky News, or it wasn't the BBC, but some other, you know, reporter. He had an exclusive interview with Michael Jackson, right? And it was very clear that the interview had been cut to make Michael Jackson seem way more loony than he could ever be. I mean, the man was not, you know, the most normal of people. But, I mean, it was cut to make him look like Tom Cruise jumping on Oprah's couch. And I feel like in a big way, if you've got your bar that has its reputation for being seedy and people are going to be a little, like, sketch or whatever, the idea that those people could go there and then some, like, YouTube reel shows up with, like, God knows what portrayal of them, I can see that getting in the way of your business.
Yeah, maybe this is more about the people that frequent the bar.
Yeah.
Yeah. You will never find a more wretched hive of scum and delicacy.
Mos Eisley the bar.
All right. Once again, speaking of privacy and people's rights to express themselves, in a statement filed last week in federal court in Maryland, the Justice Department argues that not only do individuals have a First Amendment right to record officers publicly doing their duties, they also have a Fourth and 14th Amendment rights protecting them from having those recordings seized without a warrant or due process. The statement said that the U.S. is concerned that discretionary charges such as disorderly conduct, loitering, disturbing the peace, and resisting arrest are all too easily used to curtail expressive conduct or retaliate against individuals for exercising their First Amendment rights. Core First Amendment conduct, such as recording a police officer performing duties on a public street, cannot be the sole basis for such charges. Now, this comes in response to an incident from June 2011 when Manny Garcia, a White House and Senate-credentialed photojournalist, took pictures of two police officers from the Montgomery County Police Department as they were arresting two men. He was concerned that they might be using excessive force. According to the complaint, he began taking pictures from 30 feet away, then moved back to 100 feet after police shined a spotlight at him. The only interaction Garcia had with the officers was declaring he was a member of the press, and he was only in possession of a camera. The complaint states that the police then dragged Garcia to the police car, put him in handcuffs, and threw him to the ground by kicking his feet out from under him, taunted him, threatened to arrest his wife if she came too close, and took his camera. When they had his camera, he saw the police take out the battery and video card, the latter of which was, he said, was never returned. So this sounds
like... All right, look. Rodney King.
Yeah.
Rodney King. In the case where you can see police officers beating a man, you know, nearly to death, and captured by citizen journalism before the connected age, before the current mobile digital age, you know, that's precedent enough to show that, you know, police need some level of policing. Not too long ago, I think it was 2009, there was a critical mass cycle event in New York, and the you know, the police in Times Square like basically ran out and kicked some dude over on his bike who had him doing anything, and then they tried to blame him and say some shit about how, you know, oh, he'd been doing whatever, he was taunting, some nonsense like that. But unbeknownst to them, there was footage from a cell phone that covered this kind of thing. So the fact that this is even a controversy, like the only controversy I would see is if police, if it came down that, you know, this was illegal, because the fact is, police abuse their power. Not all of them, probably very few of them, but you know, the idea that a public servant can't be viewed publicly, you know, and while they're in public doing their public job, is ridiculous.
Well, I mean, you would be surprised how many law enforcement individuals believe that this is interfering with their you know, performance of their duties.
Oh, I'm not going to be surprised with them like doing that, because, you know, these are the people who are afraid of being portrayed incorrectly or whatever, whatever, whatever. But the bottom line is that if anyone in this world is supposed to behave like with unimpeachable character, it's the people who, you know, in principle are supposed to enforce the law. So they should be aware of the scrutiny and they should be trained to deal with it, or they shouldn't have that job. And I guarantee you it's the current generation of officers that are complaining about this. You go 20 years into the future, they're not even going to care. They're just used to having a certain level of power that they no longer have. They bear scrutiny where the blue wall of silence used to protect them from everything.
Right, because remember, police vehicles also I don't know if it's – I imagine it's standard to have those dashboard cams if you remember from watching Cops back in the day.
It depends on your county, but for sure.
Right, so they already are, you know, recording other individuals, right, whoever they pull over or have – interface with in front of their vehicles. I don't see what's
wrong
with.
And they use that as evidence against those individuals should those individuals behave in a manner that is, you know, not in keeping with the law.
Right, exactly.
Unlike the situation with the coffee shop with the seedy behavior, that's a private place run by a private individual who's looking out for his liability. This is a public office being a police officer, and what people are doing is watching how they behave in public. And, you know, we all thought how – everyone knew how nuts it was that Rodney King was taken out the way he was. You know, he was treated the way he was. I think we'd all agree that that probably wasn't the first time someone got brutally beaten by police officers. It's just the first time that someone caught them.
Yeah.
And I'm sure on some level there have been a lot less beatings of people by police officers unduly because of the awareness that there are people out there that are keeping tabs on them. You know, and that's really, I think, what's up. It'd be a public disservice not to have that kind of enforcement, not to have that kind of, you know, oversight.
All right. Now, on Thursday of this week that we're recording this, we won't be hearing this. Most people won't be hearing this until Friday. And by that time, this event will already have happened the day before. But on Thursday of this week that we're recording this, a ceremony to be broadcast live at Times Square, Samsung will unwrap the Galaxy S4, its answer to Apple's latest iPhone. And this is the phone that we mentioned last week as having the the facial recognition technology that knows when your when your eyes have reached the bottom of a web page and it automatically scrolls or pauses.
Is it just me, or is there a marketing problem here, just logically speaking? If the Samsung Galaxy 3 came out before the iPhone 5, and then the iPhone 5 came out, and the Samsung people played an ad that said the next best thing is already here, then why are they positioning this phone against the iPhone 5? Why not position it for the future and forget and not even talk about how, you know, its connection to or rivalry with any kind of iPhone, any extant iPhone, I guess.
That's a good question. And again, I think, you know, you linked an article here about Samsung's the rise of Samsung's popularity and the fact that it might actually they may not even have to really sort of compete with the iPhone anymore. They're actually selling more phones than Apple is at this point, according to this article. This infographic that you have in this article here points out that they're on the road to possibly overtake the iPhone.
Yeah, which makes sense if it's already the next best thing and it's competing with the next iPhone. Moreover, but I think the big thing for me with Samsung is that long have I said that Samsung is the only company in the world that could possibly rival Apple because of its vertically integrated structure. But what I think I realized today is that it never mattered whether Samsung sold more phones than Apple until they finally accepted and anointed the Galaxy line as their true smartphone. I think if they herald it as their, you know, their flagship device.
Uh-huh.
I think on some level, I would like to see Samsung begin to step away from some of the intermediary devices, continue to make your low-end stuff, but use the Galaxy as the platform for everything. You know, we watch those, you know, you've seen the commercials, and I've played around with the tapping functionality. Right. Nowadays, the Galaxy phones interact with the TVs, the Samsung TVs, in a nice way. Samsung's got the ability to completely integrate your life. I'm talking your Samsung dishwasher, your Samsung clothes washer, your Samsung oven, and your Samsung refrigerator. Like, they make so many things. And all these things just need a Wi-Fi chip enabled in order to, you know, take the most out of them. Like, you know, basically think about Belkin Wemo integrated into everything. So I feel like Samsung's poised here, but it didn't really matter before because they were, you know, they were kind of just all over the map. And now that they've got this Galaxy situation and they've got these lawsuits behind them about patents and so on, and the Galaxy is a far different device than an iPhone, which is to their credit because they're wonderful devices, the Galaxy Note, the Galaxy S, all that stuff. So, I mean, if they really want to push here, if they really want to work for taking market share away and making these devices, like, super relevant to the everyday lives of people, they need to, you know, it's this device, it's this Galaxy device. And I'm kind of happy that they're at a point where they can tout it the way they do.
I want to go back to a discussion that we had a few episodes ago when we were talking about the Samsung versus Apple design lawsuit, and we had talked about how Samsung was okay with losing this lawsuit and having to pay the penalty because it gave them a leg up against Apple. Copying Apple's design gave them the leg up they needed to get to this point.
But the leg up wasn't against Apple at that point. It was more against the other Android manufacturers. By emulating Apple's style, they were able to squeeze out other Android manufacturers.
And look where they are now.
That wasn't the only reason they could. Again, the vertical integration. All the other guys are using some Samsung parts in their devices. Samsung doesn't have to pay the same rate for those parts because they make those parts.
That's true. I guess
Apple makes a
good point.
The vertical integration is very much the reason. It's like, you know, we talk about Tim Cook and his logistics and how he was able to get all these things done. It is amazing. Samsung, as Chobo in Korea, has that ability times a lot. And they also have 80 million people who are just going to buy devices from them or LG. Because Koreans are notoriously loyal to their handset, their native company's handsets, their local handsets. So I think that definitely helped them get a leg up, but it was less against Apple, I think, and way more against the other guys. What's really interesting is that the devices that have really taken off, the S3 and the Note, are with a design capacity that is far different from Apple, yet, you know, the award-winning design. They've gotten awards for this design, awards that Google hasn't gotten for some of their own Android phones. So it's interesting right now because the Galaxy series, you know, Galaxy S and the Galaxy S2, clearly derivative of an Apple design. The Galaxy S3, the one that's kind of like ran away with it all, that is, you know, far and away a different, very space-age looking device. And the Galaxy Note, that's its own thing. Sure, that doesn't look like anything I've ever seen.
Emulating Apple right off the gate, in order to gain that market share, gave them the confidence to be able to break away and start to innovate in their own way. Like they wouldn't have had the leverage.
Yeah, they also didn't have a choice because if the S3 had looked like an iPhone, they would have been done.
It's funny that in a sense, Apple almost like created their own competitor by, you know, basically building the, I don't know if created them, but you know, they were an important part of Samsung's rise, given that how much of their own stuff was created through Samsung, at least in the early days. I know they do more of it though now.
Let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of The Drill Down, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book that caught my eye this week is called Banished, Surviving My Years in the Westboro Baptist Church by Lauren Drain. And most people here have likely heard of the Westboro Baptist Church. They're the ones that are picketing in protesting at events such as the funerals of soldiers, victims of shootings, and other grieving families holding anti-gay, anti-Semitic, and anti-practically everything signs. And in March, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of their right to picket funerals. And since no organized religion will claim affiliation with them, perhaps it's more accurate to think of them as a cult. And as such, Lauren Drain was thrust into that cult at the age of 15 and then spat back out again 7 years later. Banished is the first look inside of the organization, as well as a fascinating story of adaptation and perseverance. So, Banished, or any of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, can be yours for free. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that 30-day trial, plus for the free audiobook, plus the 30-day trial to check out their service. If you don't like the service, if you want to give it up, then you get to keep the book for free in any case. And although I'm sure that when you get there, you'll love it. I've been an Audible subscriber for a while, and it's really gotten me into reading more often. It's now my like sort of the main medium by which I ingest books. So once again, that site is audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook. All right, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, we'll get into some gaming news involving bad DRM and good dads. So take a listen to this and come on back. Just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas, Christopher Bernor, and Tosin Onufuwakin. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times for the latest installment in the popular SimCity video game franchise. which was released this week to massive sales, and then just as quickly an epic fail as paying customers were unable to play the game they just bought. The culprit isn't the game itself, which by most accounts is pretty good. No, the problem is in the game's DRM scheme. That software requires each user to maintain an always online connection to the publisher's authentication server, even for single player mode.
It's so ridiculous, guys. I mean, how are you supposed to play a game on an airplane? I'm going to India. It's 16 hours.
Yeah.
Let me play. I have power. Why can't I play my game without spending $50 on the boing boing? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and even if you're connected, all of the cities are saved to the cloud. So if the servers for some reason should bug out, hours of work could be gone up in smoke. No more local saves.
There's just that classic situation where there's a lot of promises. They make it. I mean, we saw this with Diablo, right?
Yeah.
It's just we're as much as we're connected now. The always on internet connection for the type of gameplay that doesn't need to always be on is a problem. You should get into the game and maybe it checks when you turn it on to see if it's real. And maybe it checks half an hour later. I don't know. But, you know, there's just no reason for you to have to maintain an internet connection all the time. And if you're on a laptop or something and you're already running your game, having to be connected to the internet while that's all happening is only going to hurt. It's only going to kill your battery life even more. It also creates, I don't know how, I mean, if the game is wildly popular, how many more packets is that being sent completely unnecessarily? Yeah. That's on the backs of the carriers. This is why carriers want to do, you know, annoying things like get rid of network neutrality, because they're like, these people are abusing a network because they have no incentive to not, you know, use bandwidth when they don't have to. So on some level, I can see it's a shareholder play. Well, people aren't going to copy this one because we have the connections, but, you know, why not just make it so that it just, you know, checks it every little while or whatever. I don't know. I feel like with StarCraft 2, luckily there were no really big problems with that one. But, you know, the more popular the game, especially with The Sims, because it's not like the geekiest game, right? It's not like people who are super hardcore geeks are playing it and know what they're getting into, like with the Diablo. And Sims is really casual compared to those things. So those users are probably far more confused and perplexed as to why this is necessary when they're playing it.
I guess the question I have is, do you think the issues they're having now will change how things are done in the future?
I don't think so, because the cost to them, I mean, like, I don't know, with The Sims, this is a bigger deal than Diablo 3, like, breakdown or whatever, but in the end, the cost to them, if the game takes off and they think it's going to take off, whatever, is still somewhat lower than any initial outrage by early adopters. So
I will say one thing, and this is just strictly anecdotal evidence here, is that because all of that deliberate need to be online is baked into the code of the game, I haven't been seeing it pop up on the usual torrent sites.
I think it will at some point. They just need time to time to crack a mechanism around it. Because
how long has the game been out?
Since the 7th. But, you know, usually you see 0 days of these things come up.
Usually there's, I mean, if there's any kind of authentication, it's usually like a week or two before it shows up. In this case, someone's got, you know, they're going to hop in. Some guy in, like, Uzbekistan's going to reverse engineer some shit. Next thing you know, you know.
That would be interesting.
Maybe the issue is they haven't been able to hop in, so that's why they can't reverse engineer it yet.
Or maybe
nobody can get on, not even the pirates.
Well, normally what happens is, I feel like what I've seen in the past is they make a server that pretends to be the correct server, and then you run another program that basically only allows you to connect to that server once. Only allows you to connect to that one server that's going to fool the game, and then you're golden or whatever. That's like what I think that's what we saw with some attempts at the Diablo situation. So, you know, there are ways around it. I don't know. I feel like there's also plenty of other stuff to play, so.
Yeah, I think there'll definitely be a ways around it. But the problem is, you know, like you said, we saw this with Diablo. We saw this even before that with Spore, if you remember when Spore came out.
Oh,
that was
one of the
major titles where they tried to do some sort of DRM, and it also failed in terms of, you know, caused a lot of issues at the onslaught. And it's just, I don't know. It as a avid, you know, I do like playing with others, but there are also times where it's just having the ability to be offline and not have to be connected is something I treasure. It's, you know, it's coming part and parcel with the it's part and parcel with some of these experiences. And I find like a lot of the people who I talk to who are more casual gamers, their experience from SimCity, or at least from what they can recall from SimCity, was this game that individuals would play alone and play separate. Yeah. And so when they hear that, oh, they've been multiplayer additions to it, I think they're interested, but they still have that same dynamic of, well, although you have this additional feature, why don't you still maintain the status quo of being allowed to play online as being allowed to play offline as a sole individual? You know, I think it's one of those games where it makes you shake your head a little bit.
There's a deeper cultural issue of just people have a sense of like things should pretty much work even if you're offline, like, except for the parts that need to work when you're online, you know, like people can kind of understand like why you have to be online to play, you know, World of Warcraft, because it's supposed to be online. But, you know, even for iPhone games that require connectivity, like you can still play them. You just can't get the high scores. And it's kind of funny because it's almost going the opposite direction from how a lot of web applications are going. Like web applications like Gmail and whatnot, with the rise of local storage, are actually trying to be more functional even when there is no connectivity. And yet games at the same time, and let's face it, purely for, you know, profiteering purposes, are going the exact opposite direction. And I think it's sort of not surprising why people find it confusing, because there is no logical reason for them to be online.
Yeah, it's just stupid.
So I'm glad to see EA get smacked for that one. I don't know if you went on to Amazon,
yeah,
but there are something like 5,000 one-star reviews. And the five-star reviews are pretty hilarious. They're all about people who recovered from video game addiction or who really liked the $60 countdown timer application that EA has made. It's definitely more entertaining than playing the game is, to read through the reviews.
But the game also has bugs to it too, which is kind of sad. You know, I hear overall that, you know, without these connectivity issues and given some time to fix some of the AI issues, that the game actually looks gorgeous and would be a lot of fun. But one of the AI issues that I came across was had to do with curved road paths. Basically, AI would always take the shortest distance, no matter if the a distance which was slightly longer but was a curved road was less congested. So literally, someone made a YouTube video of this one-lane road, and right next to it, a slightly curved four-lane road, and all trucks were taking the one-lane path.
Well, it sounds like they've got some more bugs to work out. And the head of Maxis did an open sort of ask me anything over Twitter a couple days ago in light of all of the frustration that users are feeling. And she essentially said that they have no plans to deactivate or turn off the always online function of the game
requirement. Yeah. Cause it doesn't, they basically said that, you know, they're claiming that's a, but if they want to make that something that they can rely on in the future, they can't cave because of what they're going to see or what they're going to justify or rationalize as a vocal minority.
Right.
You know, they're gonna look at their shareholders and they're gonna say, or, you know, whoever is, like, you know, in they're responsible to, they've made a promise about, you know, piracy. They're taking a stand against piracy, I suppose, on some level. And come hell or high water, that's what they're gonna do. And then there's just this idea that if they want to change the culture around always on connectivity, then they're, you know, by sticking with this, you know, they're gonna be able to do that. And basically, from now on, you know that every Sims you play is going to be an always on kind of game.
Right.
It's a shame, because I gotta say, there's something very, like Tosin was saying, very cathartic, very relaxing about being able to like pop open the game, be disconnected, you know.
Yeah.
Be disconnected and just, you know, get it, embrace, you know, get in there. Sure. But I'm sure on a big level, there's also some level of analytics that's going on here. There's data, mm-hmm. you know. In The Sims, their products to work with, to buy, whatever. Those products and how they use them are going to be a benefit of the data. I don't know if they need to be always on for that. Maybe they can, you know, when you pop on, you can send the data from your last session or whatever. But that real-time data feed is going to be central to their in-game economy and what else, whatever else they want to do. So, you know, it's really, unfortunately, it's kind of about following the money and not, like, you know, the culture of the game.
All right, I think that's it for our headlines for this week. All we've got left here is our weekly viral video of the week. And this is a good one. And I have to thank you, Tosin. It was you, Tosin, that linked this to me. What I think, isn't it? Wasn't it?
Yeah. Just a random video discovered in the late hours on the internet.
So Mike Mika was playing Donkey Kong with his 3-year-old daughter. And she asked if she could play as Pauline, the female heroine, the object of Mario's rescue. And Mika explained that it wasn't possible. He says, I told her that we couldn't in this particular Mario game, and she seemed really bummed out by that. So this disappointment spurred Dad on to make the role reversal a reality and then upload the results to YouTube. So he details how he revamped Donkey Kong on the video's page. He says he's up at midnight hacking the ROM, replacing Mario with Pauline. He's using the 2010 NES Donkey Kong ROM. He redrew Mario's frames and swapped the palettes in the ROM and replaced the M at the top with a P for Pauline. So now his daughter can play as Pauline rescuing Mario from Donkey Kong. And what's more, he's made a DK Pauline patch available for anyone else interested in playing that particular version. But you should check out the video. It's basically just a video of the gameplay, but it's fairly, you know, it's a little disorienting to see because you're so used to seeing Mario jump through the course. Yeah. I didn't say I was happy about it, but I'm just something that I'm not used to seeing. And I'm pleasantly... I would love to show this to my 8-year-old and get her take on it.
I mean, this is key. It also goes to show that in 2013, even in 2010, hell, in the year 2000,
yeah,
the classic boy saves girl thing,
yeah,
it's over, right? Like, it's, yeah, you know, there's no reason why you can't have them both be together, you know, working together to save the world or whatever. So there's that. I saw another Mario hack. Well, it wasn't really a hack. It was a fake Mario game where it's basically the original Mario Brothers, but there's a cat icon that plays it. Have you guys seen this?
I have not seen that.
Oh, my God. It is ridiculous. Basically, everything you do kills you. And they have these videos. They're like hall videos where someone's just tracking how they played. And, like, you know, it's kind of like they get a friend to play it and they're recording what they're saying. They're like, oh, fuck. Oh, screw this. Oh, damn. Oh, I can't say. What the hell? it's designed completely to kill you. There's just no way out. It's wonderful because all the things that you would normally do can kill you in, like, really creative ways. So I like this age of taking these. I mean, it's like the new meme, right? The video game meme.
Yep.
Taking, you know, rather than taking a picture and throwing some words in it, let's take an interactive bit of fun and, you know, mishmash it, change it around and make it reflect the reality that would actually happen if you jumped and knocked your head against a brick or, you know, you were a girl who had to save your boy, you know?
Right, right. DIY, you know, change it yourself. If it doesn't suit your reality or your lifestyle, change it yourself. Change it to suit it. All right, let me go around the table here, and I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Check me out on Twitter.com/DwayneD. Also, check me out on flavors.me/DwayneD. You can see pretty much everything I'm up to. And that's it.
Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find my interesting links at CRISPRNOR on Twitter, CHRISBURNOR, and then I blog at CRISPRNOR.com, and you can find best startup-related events and articles at Startup Digest, where I curate them.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we people see your work?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/TOAST4321, Toast4321. And this week, instead of mentioning the podcast I'm on, I'm going to mention another thing, which you can find is the LandoSociety.org.
Oh,
so if you go to the LandoSociety.org, you should sign our petition to get Billy Dee Williams into the new Star Wars film. So
absolutely.
Check that out.
Yeah. Works every time.
Colt 45.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, Facebook.com/MrBabyMan, Twitter.com/MrBabyMan, Gplus.to/MrBabyMan is my Google Plus link. Check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network by going to geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Go to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes link is in the right-hand sidebar. And please subscribe, tell your friends, leave comments. We want to hear from you. Our show's on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, or Kindle Fire. Other devices by going to Stitcher.com, Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you get an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details, and we'll hook you up. And be sure to catch us next week at this time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
I forgot to let you guys know that I am after like a year and a half, I made my like first Steam purchase.
Oh, wow. What? You haven't made? Yeah. Wait, you haven't made a purchase in a year and a half, or
a Steam purchase? A Steam purchase.
You haven't made a Steam purchase in a year and a half, or you haven't ever made a Steam purchase until
now. I made some when I first got on it. I guess it's been longer. It's been like since 2010 or something. I haven't made a Steam purchase. I bought Left 4 Dead, and that was pretty much it. But I was reading some stuff, and I found out that my favorite game, like my favorite game by far, has been, is about to be re-released, and it's going to be re-released with via Steam with all the graphics and technology available today, and that's Age of Empires 2, Age of Kings.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I love that game.
Dude, it's just like I've been playing that game off and on since 1999. Like, if I have a couple hours free and it's like, you know, gross outside and like the girlfriend's gone or whatever, I'm firing up Age of Empires. And, you know, I'm getting into the highest resolution it supports is like 1280 by 1024. The colors are, you know, it's all bitmap. The colors are like, I don't know, I don't know, 256 colors or some shit like that. It looks terrible on a current machine. But, you know, my Ensemble Studios got the guy who helped develop it back in the day. They put him back on, and you know, they've come up with basically the game and its expansion pack together in one bundle that's like, I don't know, $18 or $17 or something like that, and it's got everything you need to play it on both Windows 8, you know, because it barely runs on, you know, some of the newer flavors of Windows, and the graphics are updated to support it. Also, the audio is updated to support, you know, 5.1, things like that. So it's not like a mind-blowing change. It's not like Age of Empires 7 or something like that. I mean, they'd be up to 4 by now. But the game was so much better than the sequel, Age of Empires 3. in terms of just this real-time strategy that doesn't have a focus on simply attacking your enemy like Warcraft or Starcraft. The focus is really building a society, building a civilization, without having the turn-based slowness of Civ. And it really is something, so I'm pretty excited. And also, you know, it happens during the whole, like, basically the medieval era into the Renaissance, so there's that whole, you know...
So it actually feels like Age of Empires as opposed to Age of Exploration or something else.
Right, and theoretically, like, you could think that there, you know, Age of Empires should have been, like, the third one was during the Exploration Age, but, you know, that's when empires really rose in some respects. The British took over all the shit, so did the Spanish. But I feel like it... As a geek, there's this romantic aspect to medieval times, which is why Game of Thrones does so well, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it really captures that. And individually, as a player, you can build an empire by taking over the other guys around you and like just expanding. So, I mean, it's a great game. I wonder how my system's going to run. Also, like, I bought it, and like you can buy the third Age of Empires game, like the full bundle, and this version of the second game, it was all like $25 or something like that, so it was pretty big. And then because, you know, you're in the store and there's a recommendation, I realized that I hadn't played Quake 3 in some time, and I bought like all the Quakes, all of them.
So like, it begins.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel, I don't know, I should have said it during like earlier, but basically I definitely played a lot of video games of the last couple days as I had to just sort of de-razify from being in Austin for the conference.
I've never been a huge real-time strategy fan, or any sort of strategy fan for that matter.
Dude, it's like an economic bliss, man. Like, it's not about, you know, I'm running around and shooting people and it's also fast. I mean, that's, you gotta fight people and that's cool and you're gonna do it and you have to figure out really well. But it's really about, like, how can you look at the situation you're in economically. How can you build the right resources, make the right bets, and do the right things? Right. Not really make the right bets, but build the right resources, you know, figure out exactly what you need, when you need it, and just be completely efficient to the point where you can build the kinds of armies that can take out your opponent without, you know, and if you do it well, it's not a question of I'm just going to rush them and take them out. It's really going to be about, like, what technology do I need to develop in order to get these guys out, and then how do I get there? Because you can't just develop technology. You have to, like, build a library or a university, and you have to have, you know, generations of people study it, but that studying really takes place in like 5 minutes. That kind of thing. So you really kind of have this holistic, you know, kind of like chief executive view of this place. And then, you know, if you want, you can, you know, manage it with, you can use religion as a weapon, you know, things like that. So it's pretty...
Walolo, walolo. Yeah.
It's the most frightening sound in the game. Because you're like, my expensive unit is about to be converted into, like, some Saracen.
You know, so one thing I just thought of, you know, from listening to you talk about this, like, with board games and whatnot, there's this tradition of, you know, taking classic games and releasing them every couple years.
Yeah.
Also, Catan, there's, you know, they re-release, you know, Monopoly every 6 months. So, you know, you can actually have, like, an up-to-date version of the old ones falling apart and everything. Like, I really hope that they start to do that with computer games. Like, there's an awful lot
of... They haven't been around for long enough, I think. I mean, I think they're just beginning to be around long enough to do this. Because, like, Monopoly, how old is that? You know, it's ancient.
Yeah, but Settlers of Catan is only, you know, 6-8 years old, and they're starting to do that. I mean, Settlers of Catan is younger than many video games, which have not been re-released. Like, there's this problem where, like,
hanging out in a paradigm that people are used to having re-releases of, I guess. You know, kind of like reprints of books, I guess. They have to continue to make it. If they're going to go at it again, I guess they have to think about that. But I totally see what you're saying. I mean, there are plenty of games that are perfect and wonderful. And just because, like, I've talked to Empires, and he's like, oh, man, well, you know, the graphics are so old, play a new thing. And I get playing the new things, but there is a nostalgia with these games. That's why, like, games like Ready, like, books like Ready Player One are so exciting to read.
Yeah.
Because it pulls you back into, you know, things that were part of your upbringing, part of what made you you in some respects.
Yeah. Nostalgia factor.
Nostalgia factor. And then also with Age of Empires, the update, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but IPX is not exactly a protocol you can use to play your friends across the internet any longer. So
that's one of the problems.
I'm really excited with the new Age of Empires that I'll be able to actually like play friends again. I'm going to probably buy it for several people just because they'll be like, oh, do I really need that or whatever? And then we'll be able to actually like kick ass. I'm hoping they updated the AI too, because over the last, you know, 14 years, I've pretty much been able to take out the hardest AI without any problem.
No.